The night may be long and the dark may be deep, but the answers are there to be found. Whether it's the normal, the abnormal, or the paranormal, you're in the right place. Let's go beyond reality.
Welcome to the program. Great to have everybody along. I'm your host, JV Johnson. I hope you're being smart. I hope you're being safe. And I hope you're doing the right thing. We've got an interesting show for you tonight. We're going to be talking to two different guests in the later part of the program, the latter part of the show. We're going to talk to Michael Telstar. He is a professional escape artist. He's also a remote viewer. He's a master paranormalist. We're going to find out what all of that means with Michael in the second part of the show. In the first part of the show, we're going to be talking to a businessman and a philanthropist, Frank Scurlock. We're going to talk about this pandemic's effects on charities and the people that use those charities to survive. Please support the program. Go to patreon.com/johaw. That's J-O-H-A-W.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Frank, welcome to Beyond Reality. It's great to have you on with us.
Appreciate the opportunity to talk to you.
So let's get right into this because we don't have a lot of time with you tonight. But obviously, we are in a situation, third week into what is considered to be basically a lockdown for most of the country. People can't go to work. There is some kind of relief coming from governments, but it's not very timely. It's not very speedy. And people run out of money quick in this day and age. And when they don't have money, they can't buy food. So they look for help. They go to places like food banks and other charitable organizations that can help them out. But the pandemic has hit those too. What's going on around us that we need to be aware of?
We need to get right back to the basics of life. I mean, we really do. I mean, economics is certainly important, and that can't be ignored, but you can't teach responsibility for mismanagement and failure to plan overnight. It's not going to catch up. You got to just hit the ground and figure out what's the right thing to do and how to rebound. So what we're doing is we are launching something called America's Bounce Back. It's americasbounceback.com. And it's going to be a series of things. There's actually a lot of good things, ironically, coming out of this. The family values, you know, there's a very small percentage of America that ever really homeschool kids. It's usually like people of Christian faith or other denominations that were the homeschoolers.
Right.
Now, it's all of America gets to experience what it's truly like to spend time 24/7 with your family, your children, your in-laws, everybody. And that's what you got to look at it from a new perspective is with the time that we're allotted, what do we do with that time? Where do we invest that time? And that's kind of what how we kind of got involved in this. I'm basically was retired for a few years, but what I did over my professional lifestyle, my parents happened to invent this inflatable amusement ride called a spacewalk. It's, you know, you blow it up at your house, you bounce up and down, you have a good time.
Sure, yeah.
My mother coined the phrase, here comes fun. And our corporate website for that is herecomesfun.com. And what that really was about, yes, we made money and all that, you have to, it's a business. But at the end of the day, it's about bringing people together. And that's what we've done. The home-based entertainment is about to skyrocket. I'm actually talking to you this evening. Ironically, I live in a little town called Celebration, Florida, which actually happens to be on the ground of Walt Disney World. And very sadly, very tragically, all Disney theme parks throughout the world are at a full ground stop right now.
Yeah.
And there's really... I can't even say there's no end in sight because it's just not fair. It defies the principle of what Walt himself would have done. However, if you put Walt in perspective of the old question, what would Walt do? And he would focus on bringing the family unit back together. Most people don't realize how it happened. Walt wanted to spend that quality time with his daughter. That was that magical bench that he sat at in San Francisco with the merry-go-round, and boom, it ended up going global. So kind of using that role model, which, of course, Walt is one of mine, being in the amusement and leisure business, we said, what can we do? So we want to paint a very positive message, a very positive vibe, is there's always hope. There's always opportunity. The thing that I'm really, really troubled with, in the past 12 hours, I've had texts and calls in over 3 potential suicide victims.
Oof.
And so I dedicated more than half today getting psychiatrists involved, pharmacies involved. And these are people that most of them didn't even have hospitalization. They don't have a psychiatrist. And then they don't know how these drugs will potentially interact their body. So from there, you know, you got the psychiatrist, which is the medical side. You got the therapy side. Does anybody think about all the counselors that are going to be needed in the very near future? So whoever let's call it the patriarch of a family, that would be, when I was a kid growing up, it was my Aunt Linda. She became the patriarch. Nobody messed with Linda, and most importantly, everybody followed Linda, or else she got in trouble. So we need leadership. Somebody needs to set the ground rules straight, and then you bring it back together. You know, I was born in 1962. It was a lot more simpler time. If you look at the really big achievements through my grade school years, the nation came together, and we basically utilized the space program, brought us together. I remember in grade school watching it, have my father, actually, that's how he got involved in the inflatables. He worked for NASA in New Orleans at a facility called the Michoud Assembly Facility. They actually made the stack, or in other words, the Apollo rockets were actually based in New Orleans and floated to Cape Canaveral. But that's what he was doing, leading to his industry. I'm the little kid in tote saying, watching all this magic come about, and he invents his inflatables, and we dedicated our family and our business to serving people. Now, here's the connection. It's not up to me to save them. It's up for them to save themselves. And that it's the whole thing. Is it half full? Is it half empty? Is there a tomorrow? But when they say, is there a tomorrow, they got to think for a second, wait a minute, I just went through today. So there is going to be a tomorrow. That's actually guaranteed if you let it. And one of the things that we find, and as President Trump keeps saying, don't let the cure be worse than the problem. Earlier tonight, I was at a gas station at 8:30 Eastern time trying to get gas, and I had to go to the bathroom. And you know what? They said, oh, you can't go in there because we just sanitized it so we can have it ready for tomorrow. And I said, well, what time do you close? They said, midnight. And I said, well, wait a minute. What happens to the people that come in after you sanitize it? And they said, you know, you got a point there. And so we need to really slow this big thing down and just break it into little bitty pieces. And here's it. I had an incredible vision this afternoon. I said, this is the dilemma between the tortoise and the hare. It's what it is. The media is spinning it so fast, in our president, our government, the whole thing. They're delivering the worst conceivable news ever. God bless them for having strength to even get up on the stadium to speak to everybody. But when you think about it, if we're flying it so fast, saying, quite frankly, a lot of people are just turning the dial off. They know the message is going to be there. They know it's not going to be good. So let's go into the turtle and the tortoise mentality.
Well, well, Frank, I just have to interrupt you because there's a bunch of different things that you brought up that I want to kind of tackle one by one. But one of the things that strikes me is that, you know, we have two things to be afraid of here. One of them is obviously a very, very direct health issue.
No doubt about it.
We see numbers of people dying. Basically, overnight, we wake up and another couple thousand people have died. We're not used to that. And especially the way, as you pointed out, you know, 24-hour news channels just keep reporting this stuff nonstop. But we're also looking at something that in some ways can be even more frightening. And that is the economic impact of all of this. We've had unemployment at filings at record highs when we knew this was coming. I mean, the government basically shut down all businesses in some parts of the country and said, don't go to work, don't open your doors. And in some cases, they're threatening people with imprisonment or fines if they do.
Very sad.
So
yeah,
there's an economic...
I heard in Los Angeles, they're literally drawing guns on people if they don't have the requirement of going to the store or receipt or a doctor or a hospital.
Yeah, this is, and that's a third issue that I wasn't even going to mention, and that's this this military state that we seem to have woken up in that we're not used to. But let's go back to the second one, this economic apocalypse. That right now we're too worried about face masks and washing our hands, justifiably. But at some point, there's going to be a hangover for all this, and it's going to be an economic
one. You
took
the word right out of my mouth. So I'm actually from New Orleans, okay? And, of course, everybody pretty much knows about Bourbon Street. Have you had an opportunity to walk down Bourbon Street before?
I personally have not, no.
Okay, well, guess what? When you have a good night, you do end up usually with the hangover, and you took the exact words. It is going to be an economic hangover beyond belief. However, here's the beautiful side of that. Of course, I didn't go through the Depression and all that stuff, but, you know, we got some good history books kind of show us what happened. Then we got the Hoovervilles that popped up there and things like that. Society has advanced really through technology. I mean, just look at what the major retailers, specifically Walmart, has done. You know, once they got in really military mode, I just was out there today. They are completely packed and they are ready to go with food. That's the very first thing that comes to people's mind. They obviously, well, they really thought the opposite. They thought it was the bathroom, so that's why they ran on the toilet paper. But at the end of the day, it's about consumption of food. So here's something. Did you happen to hear about the video out of the French Quarter in New Orleans of all the rats taking over?
I have not, no.
So there was a video that a friend of mine shot, and it went viral on Facebook, and actually CBS News picked it up. It was on the morning show this past weekend. And so my friend is a historian also, and he's videoing all the incredible buildings in the French Quarter. And all of a sudden, he just noticed they're being overrun by hundreds, if not thousands, of rats because they're in seek of food, okay, because they're starving.
Yeah.
And when I saw that come down, I said to myself, my goodness, that's going to be the exact same thing that's going to happen on an economic sense. And, you know, yes, everybody's getting ready to get their stimulus check. You know, if they pay their taxes, if they have good information on file, and quite frankly, I don't even know if you even have to be somewhat legit. You would think that you should, but a lot of people are getting ready to get a lot of money, but it's not enough, and it will never be enough.
Right.
So that's when it also goes into, you know, and I hate to use this phrase, and I might have already said it once, you cannot teach responsibility overnight. Also, the housing and stuff, and quite frankly, I'm really greatly concerned about the potential economic, I don't even know if I'd call that a hangover. That's just an apocalypse getting ready to happen.
Sure is.
I mean, you have no revenue, nothing more than handouts and stuff, and you got pre-existing built-in mortgage, rent, or even if you're debt-free, you still have other obligations. You got your taxes, you got your insurance, then you got your, just like you said, your cell phones, all your associated things. So a simplification of life is definitely in order, and it's going to be a good reflection for everybody. However, once again, there's hope. Because I have past international business experience, the other night between midnight and 4 o'clock in the morning, I called several countries. I called South Africa, Taiwan, Hong Kong, China, and India. And you know what all those countries were doing when I called them? Absolutely nothing. They were actually at a full ground stop like we are here.
Right.
And so I was thinking about it, and I started asking, well, what is your government doing? And they're really kind of being very evasive. At least we have a great big printing press. When Trump signed the stimulus package, I said, you know, back in the days of the impeachment and stuff, they had the pens and stuff like that. I said, well, he needs to take out the gold pen because what he just signed, in my opinion, is probably the largest check ever written in the history of this country.
I think that's probably true, yeah.
And that was just the first one. And quite frankly, I think that was the, you know, when you go buy a house, you put up some earnest money to initiate it. I think that was the earnest money. We got some much, much bigger things. And so we were in this hamster wheel that was going so fast. We almost were, you know, they always said keeping up with the Joneses. At this time, it just doesn't matter. You are yourself. When you came down the birth canal, who were you with? It was really you and God, right? And so when you think about it, that's how it is. I'm a highly spiritual person. And by the way, it's not promotion of any language or, excuse me, any religion. It pretty much all goes back to the same principles. And this is where it's the simplification, and perhaps maybe at a much later time in life, or should I say at an earlier time in life, it was that way. But all of a sudden, we sped it up and we complicated it. And the ride was fun. It was amazing. But the ride now is going to be those simple Leave It to Beaver type days. You remember that wonderful program on TV?
Sure, yeah.
Mrs. Cleaver and stuff like that, and Wally. It has to go there. And quite frankly, it really needs to go straight into Alice in Wonderland. Because it's what you perceive. I mean, what I like to call it, I always love to be a proponent of living in the now. Let's just move on. This is the NOW time. So let's push forward. And our thoughts, just like your show, which I think is wonderful, you make your own reality.
We have just a couple of minutes left with you. I do want to just paint a little bit of a picture and get your take on it. So I live in and broadcast from Cooperstown, New York. You may know of it as the home of the Baseball Hall of Fame.
Been there, yep.
We have about 1,000 full-time residents. The county itself has a total of 60,000. It's a very rural area. The closest city that has any kind of mall or shopping of any kind is an hour and a half away. So we're a bit remote. We're very rural. This town, and the whole county for that matter, thrives on a summertime tourism population. And this tourism population comes for the Baseball Hall of Fame, but more importantly, recently, it comes because there is a facility here called the Cooperstown Dreams Park, which brings in 120 or so teams, baseball teams, of 12-year-old boys every week. 120 teams of 12-year-old boys every week, and they play a week's tournament, and then they go home, and it starts all over the next week. So for 10 weeks of the summer, we get 120 teams times 15 kids per team, plus mom and dad and maybe a sibling or two. They all come here. They eat. They drink. They buy stuff in the shops. That's the economy. And the sales tax revenue from that activity supports the entire county, not just the village of Cooperstown. So because of this pandemic, this facility, Cooperstown Dreams Park, announced they will not have any tournaments for 2020. So all of the businesses and the local governments that rely on the sales tax and the businesses that rely on the commerce will have no season for all of 2020. So that means about 18 months without any significant revenue. I don't care what kind of stimulus check comes out of Washington or Albany or wherever it comes from. I don't see a fix to that. That is not something that most of these businesses can actually rebound from. They can get a check that covers 3 months, but what about the other 15 months where they will not have the revenue to pay their mortgage, their rent, their whatever it happens to be? I see this to be a far deeper problem than just, you know, the weeks or a couple of months that we're going to be stuck at home.
Yeah, and I heard your voice this then. Your vibration, I hear your concern. And this early this morning, I had a conference call about 6 o'clock with some very significant economic people that have gone into Detroit, revived it. They were actually in Puerto Rico this morning, reviving that. And we were just, you know, sharing minds and observations around. And one of the people in our call came up with, and he shared what I believe will be the two words that we will take forward from this. And that is, at the end of the day, the whole world was affected, as I just confirmed, but we're going to come back America strong. And that America strong is only going to exist because of a new philosophy in life. And those two words are reverse globalization.
I've said for a long time that if we're going to start spending more federal money, which is borrowed money, And we all have to recognize that. If we're going to start spending more of that, it should be some of it should be used to bring manufacturing back to the United States from China, particularly of our pharmaceutical industry, which it's a scary, scary concept that China, which is
look, when New Orleans got taken out by the hurricane, my factories were there. We were vertical. We built our own products, and we had 200 chains. So I went to China. I lived China for over 10 years, and I agree 100%. It is incredibly how they stole our economy from us.
Yeah.
So we can get it back. Just look at the shipping logs of everything. If you want to have fun, there's actually a container program that you can see where all the shipments used to come from. Everything came from China.
Yeah.
Let's stop that.
Yeah. I agree. Frank, we're out of time. Thanks so much for joining us and providing a bit of a message of hope here. Give me one more a sentence description of what your website, americasbounceback.com, is about so people know what they're to expect when they go there.
You know, first off, it's not launched officially because things are happening so fast. Our launch date is Sunday, is Easter Sunday for the resurrection. So it's about just the rebounding, and it's at the end of the day, it's about saving humanity.
Terrific. Again, Frank, thanks for being here. A pleasure to talk to you. Look forward to having you back on at some point. We can chat again.
All right. God bless and have a great night.
Have you found the Noodle Shark yet to save money? It's on Facebook, The Noodle Shark. Don't forget to swing by the YouTube channel. Please subscribe. Go to YouTube, search for my name, JV Johnson. The channel's actually called JV Johnson's Beyond Paranormal. It's a great place to catch up on back episodes. There's about, I don't know, I think there's 600 back episodes or so on the YouTube channel. However, when I look at the official count, it doesn't say that many. It says about 500. So I'm not sure where the disparity is. I don't know. But anyway, there's a lot of them there. Nonetheless, there's no charge to subscribe. Just click the subscribe button. It's very, very simple. Also find the show on all major podcast distribution platforms. Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher. It's there, and it's very easy to subscribe, and you get the show downloaded to your smart device automatically. That gives you an opportunity to catch up on a program if you miss one of the live broadcasts, like this one that we're doing right now. If you do join us for the live broadcast, be sure to join us on the YouTube channel for the live chat. That's a lot of fun as well. Our second guest of the evening is Michael Telstar. Michael's a master paranormalist. He's an escape expert. We're going to be talking about that. We're going to be talking about mind over matter and remote viewing with Michael. Michael, welcome to Beyond Reality. Great to have you.
I'm happy to be here, JV.
I'm sorry we kept you waiting. I know I told you, I think I told you, or Slick Eddie told you that we'd have you on about 11:30 our time, so we're a few minutes late. So thank you for being patient.
Well, better late than never.
How did you get started? How did you get started with all of this? You know, not everybody wakes up in the morning and says, "I'm going to escape from dangerous situations for a living."
Well, I got into escape artistry around 14 years old. I read a book about Houdini, and I was fascinated by his exploits and by his mind over matter ability to escape from any bonds, shackles, wouldn't matter what it was, straitjackets. And I studied and read all about him, and I started doing these crazy escapes, and I became a professional at 17, where I was also the youngest person to perform the most dangerous escape, which was the water tank escape, where you go upside down, you know, your feet are shackled, you go upside down, and you escape from this large tank of water. So that was a world record, my first world record, and then I got six more after that in escapology.
That's amazing. You should be admired for that, but I want to talk about this Houdini connection, because I, too, was fascinated with Houdini as a kid, and I actually chose Houdini as a character to do a biography or report in school one year on, read his biography, you know, fascinating character. And he is one of these people that remains fascinating to this day. You know, he was doing his thing about 100 years ago, and yet to this day, he is one of the most intriguing people of pop culture. What makes him so enduring?
Well, Houdini was an incredible showman. And he wasn't, you know, he started from the very bottom rung of the ladder. He started doing magic with cards. He built his talent and his abilities up with time. And he's just an incredible showman. And he knew, you know, during the Great Depression, he was around and he would do these incredible escapes. And so he would give everybody watching him a temporary escape from their life, so to speak. So he would challenge anybody, carpenters, mechanics, engineers, anyone to come up with something that they would, you know, lock him up in, and he would have to escape. And I guess he was just somebody that never turned down a challenge, but he also never did an escape that he knew he couldn't escape from. Although he did have several close calls where he almost died.
Yeah. I know that to be true as well. Did he blaze this trail, or did he stand on the shoulders of others that did this before him?
No, he was the most famous escape artist who ever lived, but he was also an incredible illusionist. He was the first illusionist that made an elephant disappear, just to let you know, and he was the first illusionist that made an eagle appear.
Huh.
So other performers came after him doing similar feats, but he knew a lot about how the mind worked, and he did admire Rabah Houdin. Rabah Houdin was a illusionist during the 1850s, and he was a master watchmaker, and he turned his talents to an illusion, and also automatons, where he would make these incredible robotic figures and illusions. And the French government actually hired him to be a secret agent, and that was fascinating as well. A lot of people didn't know that, of course, when he was around. So he would use his illusionary talents, you know, in his work. And Houdini read his book and became smitten with him. And that's why he changed his name from Eric Weiss to Houdini. And I like j'aime in French, which I like. So he put the word I, letter I, at the end, Houdin, and that became Houdini. And that's he got his name.
So you were inspired by all of that, and you decided to start doing some of this on your own. You started rather young. I know that you set some records and tried some very, very, what I would consider to be dangerous escapes as a teenager, in fact. Tell us a little bit about that, and how did you start? What types of escapes did you start with, working your way up to the water cell torture escape?
Well, as a little test, you know, to test out some of the theories and some of the techniques that I learned, I had my friends tie me up with rope, 10 feet, 20 feet, up to 100 feet of rope, and they would tie me up in all manner of ways, and I would always escape. And they didn't understand how I did it, and I did, of course. I learned lung control. I would inhale as much air, contract my muscles, you know, to be able to have some, be able to escape from the ropes. And basically, I just built up my way from there. I took a locksmithing course, learned how to pick locks. I might have been more successful as a career criminal I'd wanted to be. I'm just kidding on that. But but from there, I got a straitjacket, learned how to get out of a straitjacket. I have a world record for getting out of one 21 times in 6.5 hours. And I did this in Edmonton for the Edmonton Klondike Days, and I also raised money for a charity. And then I got into the water escapes. The tank escape was probably the most difficult one that I did. And I still have my second tank today. The death plunge was a boat escape where I was handcuffed, shackled, and manacled to a rowboat. And the rowboat had explosives on it, set to go off in 4 minutes. It was towed from the shore, 150 feet from the shore. I had the bomb squad, the police, the harbor master, ambulance, and I had a scuba diver there in case something went amiss. Something did. I went in the water 2 hours before the stunt to get used to the cold water. It was very cold. It was October 28th when I did the stunt. And I got used to the cold water. That was fine. But what I didn't anticipate was that after I escaped my restraints and I dove into the water, when the bomb exploded, the concussion and the shock waves pushed me directly to the bottom, which was about 25 feet from the boat. Mm. And while it did that, it took most of the oxygen out of my lungs. I wasn't totally out of all my restraints yet. And because of that shock wave pushing me right down, it kind of put me in a small daze. Scuba diver noticed something wrong, came down to the ball and pulled me up. If I hadn't had him there, JV, I probably would have drowned.
Wow.
And I hadn't had him there. I would have drowned. Would have been too late for them to swim out 150 feet, you know, and retrieve me. But I'm not even sure if I would have made it to the top, to tell you the truth. But being cautious, I did have a scuba diver there. He always accompanied my water.
Sure,
steps.
Sure, yeah. I want to take this back to the beginning. And something, by the way, Michael, I'm not sure if you're near an electronic device, but something's causing some interference with your phone. If we can figure out what that is to avoid it, it'd be helpful. But
I'm in a quiet place now. But are you still picking it up?
Right now, I'm not.
Furnace, maybe?
Nope. Right now, I'm not. No, there's no noise now.
Okay.
It was coming and going a little bit there. But anyway, let's go back to the basic escape here. Let's talk about the straitjacket. How do you, if you could describe this for somebody, how does someone get out of a straitjacket?
Well, I guess you'd have to be crazy to get in one first, right? No, I'm just kidding. But straitjacket is a device that was straight used to put out people. And it was a very barbaric form of restraint. And it would be several straps that would your arms would go in like an inverted coat. And basically, I had to learn how to increase my lung control, how to expand my lungs, and basically be very nimble. It's not easy to get out of the straitjacket. Obviously, it's built so that the more effort you put into escaping, the tighter it becomes as well. So you have to learn how to direct the energy and be able to direct it in such a way so that you could escape. And escaping from the straitjacket upside down was always easier than doing it right side up.
Oh, really?
I found it was easier because gravity would help me to escape with my jacket.
So it's actually easier to escape when you're upside down.
Yes, because I'm exerting energy, but not as much because I'm standing. If I'm doing it right side up, I'm tumbling and I'm somersaulting on the ground, trying to get, rolling on the ground, trying to get some slack and so on and so forth. And upside down, though, I have the gravity and I can wiggle, basically have a lot of energy there, but wiggle, the jacket has a strap that goes in between the legs that's strapped, to the back. So you'd have to work your hands out of the sleeve somehow and get your hand to that strap at the back to remove the strap that's in between your legs. So if you don't know how to get out of it, of course, it's going to be painful. And you're not, most people won't be able to get out of it.
Yeah. Now, I'd heard that Houdini would dislocate his shoulders or something. Is that true?
That's one of the myths of Houdini. Let me just put it this way. His shoulders were very, very nimble man. You have to be very nimble and almost a circus acrobat to be able to get out of the straitjacket. But though he didn't dislocate his shoulders, but he probably did have them dislocated in some stunts, and that is a result of the straitjacket.
Okay. Well, he was. I think, if I remember correctly, first of all, he was very, very fit, but secondly, he was. He was a kind of a smaller man, wasn't he?
Yes, 5 feet, 5 inches tall.
Yeah.
Very powerfully built.
Yeah.
His muscles were his abdominal muscles were like oak boards. He'd have strong men from the audience punch him in the midriff.
Yeah.
And just to see how, he would get his stomach muscles tensed. And that's ultimately what causes death, though, unfortunately, one of the things that happened to him.
Yeah. To describe the water cell torture escape for people that aren't familiar with that particular escape that Houdini was famous for.
Yeah, it's a water tank. It's about 6 feet by 3 feet square. And my legs are placed in a kind of a large manacle type thing, and my hands would be handcuffed or I'd be put in the straitjacket. I'd be raised upside down, and then lowered into the tank, and the mechanism at the top would be locked to the tank. So the idea, of course, is to escape from that before you drown. And it's a myth as well, too, that Houdini died doing that stunt, which is not true. I know the Houdini movie with Tony Curtis, 1952, does show that.
Yeah.
But he didn't die doing the tank. He had the tank stunt in his act for 13 years, JV. So, and Houdini also had an emergency precaution. If something happened to him where he felt he would pass out or he could not escape, he had two special plugs at the very bottom of the tank. And he would put his hand on a handle, either plug, and give it a good twist. And then, of course, he would pull it out, and then the water would just come out. But he never had to use that in his life. He never had to use that safety precaution, but he had that built. He also had it built, too, because it was easier to get rid of the water from the tank, empty it. But it was really an emergency precaution in case he couldn't escape.
So that must be quite a feat. Given all of these escapes and the level of danger that are that's associated with some of them, have you ever felt that afraid during an escape attempt to the point where you started to panic?
Well, yes, because if you're not confident, if you know what you're going to do and you're not confident, then you're going to panic. And I learned to control my emotions. I knew what to do, and I had to, you know, follow the procedure. But there were times when I was younger where I may not have been as confident or overconfident, or I may not have been able to rehearse it as much, because it's sometimes difficult to rehearse these kind of things, like the boat stunt, for example. But there were times where I felt like I was going to drown a few times, and you know, where I felt I was going to, my legs were going to be released from the 90 feet up in the air, upside down, and felt like my legs were slipping through the rope because the person who tied me, my legs to the crane, did not do it properly. So there were a few times where I felt like, if I moved too much or move in the wrong way, I would go right down. Of course, I got a safety belt. I got wise to that. I got a safety belt, which I had strapped around me just in case my legs didn't release. And that way, it would be an uncomfortable drop, you know, but at least that I would hit my head and smash it on the concrete below.
Right, right. Let's move on and talk a little bit about some of this other work that you do. One of the things that you say is you believe that we're more than our physical selves. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, well, we're more than our physical selves. We're multidimensional beings, JV, and basically we have the physical body, we have the non-physical, body, the astral body, if you want to call it that. We got the dream body. You know, we're able to visit these other locales, and that's what I refer to as the ultimate escape, and that's what got me into the energy. You know, and the other applications of what I was doing, I got interested in that relatively young as well. And I did have some out-of-body experiences. So I went to the Monroe Institute. Mr. Monroe was the pioneer in the out-of-body phenomena. And as some of your listeners might know, and I learned there, I took the programs there. I was having a lot of OBEs. And fear is a terrific inducement to having OBEs. And I was having a lot of fear, but not from the physical escapes, but not from the non-physical ones, from the escaping from my body, so to speak. I was having conscious OBEs, and they were very frightening, and because I would see these entities, I would see these beings, and I wasn't sure if I was dreaming, but I knew I was awake, and they would be very vivid, very real. And so I went to the Monroe Institute to learn how, you know, what this ability was, and to learn how to develop it. So we're not just physical beings, you know. We have energy, we're energetic beings, and we have, the astral body, as I mentioned. And so we're more than our physical selves, and we're more, you know, and because of that, we can perceive that which is greater than the physical world. And we're not just, in other words, we're not just stone, you know, mortar, you know, stone or flesh and blood. But we have this capacity to, you know, have an OBE, become awake and aware in a dream state, which is lucid dreaming, and so on.
Now, obviously, the escape performances that you give, you know, when people go see something like this, they don't expect magic to be happening behind the curtain or whatever it happens to be. They expect somebody with some real skill perform an amazing stunt. So part of your life is that, which is a real physical thing. I mean, it's demanding on your body. It's very, very physical. And then you're saying there's another part of your interest and things that you've pursued that are very metaphysical. They're spiritual in a sense. They are mind over matter, if you will, one of the things that we're going to talk about tonight. Do the two go hand in hand? Are they two very distinct things?
Well, no, they do go hand in hand. And the thing is that, you have to be able to first know that you're more than your physical self. And many people will realize that through a near-death experience or through a conscious or unconscious OBE. And basically, people that have had surgery, will talk about having left their body and describing the surgeons and what was happening, during surgery. It happens, through fear, through different things will trigger it. And, of course, you don't have to die to have a conscious OBE, which, you know, ultimately you're going to have, and that'll be one of the ultimate escapes, right? But I think that when people realize that they really, really are more than their physical selves, they can understand energy. And the physical domain here is, well, it's a reality for us, but it's also a great illusion, JV. So it's a dense reality, you know, and there are other realities that are actually more, how shall I say, they're more real than this one here. And so those realities we can tap into, and we are connected to them. We're multidimensional, so we have that capacity to do that.
You said you've had, I think you used a plural, you've had multiple out-of-body experiences.
Yes.
And you're not talking about near-death experiences where your heart stopped beating. You're talking about just out-of-body. Describe one of them to us. What did you see, and how long did it last?
I started having them around 12, 13, 14 when they were happening pretty regularly. And I would be, you know, sleeping. And I noticed that my body was bilocated, or I would wake up and there was a bilocation. So I felt myself laying down on the bed, but I also felt myself elevated anywhere from a few inches to a couple of feet. And and I know what was happening there, but I didn't know why it was happening. I didn't know a lot about it yet. I thought a lot of the, you know, kids were having it. It was a regular state of being that, you know, that everybody experienced, but that wasn't the case, of course. I told my father about my experiences, and he took me to the Clark Institute here in Toronto and to see if there's anything wrong with me, and they told them I was fine. So anyway, they didn't ask all these questions, you know, that I thought they would ask, but basically, so I had these experiences, and I had a lot of when I got, you know, I was able to induce them to a certain degree consciously, and I would hear these voices, you know, I would see these beings that look like ogres or monsters, or I don't know what you would call them, you know, and I didn't know what it was. And there were some periods where I didn't sleep for 24, 48, 96 hours because the fear was so vivid and real that I didn't want to go to sleep because I have a conscious projection, or I would wake up out of my body there in the bedroom or whatever, and I'd see these beings.
Michael,
for a while. That's why I went to the Monroe Institute at 21 years old.
Yeah, Michael.
Was to get rid of the fear barrier.
Michael, I just want to understand this. So when you were having these out-of-body experiences, you were you could see your other self, like if you were lying in bed or whatever it happened to be, you could see that. And then you also saw these other beings. You described them as ogres.
Ogres or, they were
monsters of some kind.
And they would threaten to kill me.
Hold on.
To kill me, come out, we're waiting for you, you know, and it's almost like if you were there, imagine if you were lying in bed physically, you woke up to two or three, you know, people that, or somebody that broke into your house and threatened to kill you if you got out of the bed, right? And it was that vivid. It was that real. It was not dream. It was not a dream. Or
right.
Whatever.
No. But what I'm trying to figure out here is what you may have been seeing. You know, you're describing something, and I'm trying to make a connection here. So you were seeing yourself, plus you were seeing these ogre figures, these monsters, and you said that they were menacing. They were threatening to kill you. Were you watching them? Were they attacking or doing something to your physical body? And you were above this, watching the scene?
No, like when I say that I was observing it, I would be out of my body. I would see a body on the bed. It was my body,
right?
But it didn't look like my body, but it looked different because I'm looking with wrong physical eyes.
Yeah.
And most people are not going to look back because they're not going to have it's going to last that long. They're not going to think about turning around and looking down. But I did see these beings, and I would like literally fly out of the house, just fly through a window, fly out, and it would follow me.
Were you doing that consciously? Were you trying to escape what you were seeing? Is that why you would fly out of the house?
Yes, because they were there. They were there. The presence was there. And at first, the fear would make me go back to my body quickly, but I would stay out longer, longer, longer. And I realized they really couldn't hurt me, which took, you know, 3-4 years for me to realize that I would stay out longer. And then they didn't bother me anymore. I didn't have any more problems with them. But it took me a while to get rid of the fear barrier.
What do you think those beings were? Do you think there was some type of demonic presence? Do you think it was an alien presence?
I think they were just beings that fed on emotion. You know, call them what you will, elementals, demons, or whatever. But and I met a lot of beings through this state. I met a lot of beings, you know, and I learned not to be as objective as possible, not to be subjective, because that was really important. You see something that looks like a demon and you act in fear, then you're going to react like it's a demon. And it may not be a demon at all. And it may be something with wings, and it's not something what you think of as an angel. I mean, so people will usually be subjective. So I learned when I went to the Monroe to be objective and not to label what I saw, just to observe it and to see it for what it was. But I did encounter a lot of life forms, many life forms, and also different locales that I realized, the physical and non-physical locales. Locale 2 was a lot more interesting, which is a non-physical universe, by the way. Places where people go, where they pass away, and, you know, entities. But there are entities that feed on fear. Fear is a powerful emotion, and it's food to them. It's matter to them. So they will cause fear in human beings, and they continue to do this up to this day, and they will feed on that emotion and absorb it. So they'll do that to you. And there are beings, of course, beings that are physical, non-physical, that will feed on fear too, right? As you know, tyrants, right? But yeah, there are beings that will do that to you. Once you learn to do the experience, once you learn to have the OBEs at will, and you learn to understand that they can't harm you, which could take a while, but you can do it, then you'll have these incredible experiences.
Did you have, just a quick answer to this one, please, did you have any explanation from anyone that you went to seek some counsel for regarding these experiences as to what you may have been witnessing? Did anybody give you an explanation?
Yeah, Mr. Monroe. That's why I went to the Monroe Institute. Their first program was 7 days long, and I read his book, Journeys Out of the Body, Far Journeys. And in the books that he had, he explained there was many scenarios and many experiences that he had had, which I had as well. And they were, you know, it's like, there is a commonality there, because there are places that exist in the non-physical, just as physical places exist. So when I read his books and I went to the Monroe, the girlfriend I was dating at the time told me about the place, and I went there and I took their 7-day program, and then I went many times after that. And then basically you know that you're not, you know, you're okay, but you have to understand that if you have these, you have to be careful who you tell, because there are people too that will to tell the parents or tell others, and if they're not enlightened enough, they may suspect that you have something wrong with you and then give you a drug, which is bad. So there's a lot of people probably that have these experiences that unfortunately probably are on medication or drugs that prevent them from having it consciously, or, you know, they just don't, you know, it prevents them from feeling anything, right? So they won't have the experience, you know, consciously. Right. They'll just have it unconsciously. And everybody has this, by the way, every night. Everybody believes their body every night. Everyone does it without, there's no doubt in my mind, everybody will leave their body and go to different places, but they're doing it unconsciously. When you start to become conscious, that's when you start, you know, picking up on these things. I mean, they affect you consciously as well.
So you can do this at will now? You can actually control and direct this at will?
Yes, I do it. I project about 3-4 times a week. I have lucid dreams at night, where I wake up and become aware of the dream state. And I had both these experiences for many years, and I didn't know what I was doing at first when I was younger, and then I learned to tell the difference between having an out-of-body experience and having a lucid dream. And it's not impossible for people to learn. And I think with all the time we have on our hands these days, people can learn how to lucid dream. Lucid dreaming would be easier to learn first, but they could also, you know, once they start having that and they become conscious of the dream state, that they'll start having OBEs as well. And I have some techniques on my website on the lucid dreaming and an OBE state too. If people check my site, they can check out some of the techniques that I have there.
Okay. So you had these out-of-body experiences. You went to the Monroe Institute. You got some counsel. You learned how to control them. You actually perform them at will. When does remote viewing come into the picture for you?
Well, remote viewing, it came into the picture. I guess I started remote viewing too, I guess, in my teens. You do, everybody remote views. It's a modern terminology for clairvoyance, right? So basically, it's the ability to perceive people, places, and other things that are remote in time and space and bring back information on a target or something that you're seeing. So people, they dream, they pick up images, they pick up sounds, they pick up impressions. That's remote viewing in a way, right? So there is a protocol that you can learn that can teach the average person to remote view. Some people will be more naturally attuned to it than others, but I have taught about 6,000 people how to remote view in my various programs, and you can learn the technique, and it's a lot easier to learn to remote view to have a conscious OBE. But once you start learning to remote view, there's so much that you can do in that state.
So you teach because people, basically, you actually teach people how to remote view.
Yes. Yes.
Let me ask you this.
My knowledge and teaching for the last probably 30 plus years.
One of the things that we do on this program every once in a while, we're not going to do it tonight, but I will do what I call a remote viewing psychic experiment. I make it rather somewhat easy. I use a deck of playing cards, and I pull a card from the deck, and I ask, and I focus on it, concentrate on it, and I ask my listeners to call in and try to connect with me and the card and tell me what the card is. We don't have a whole lot of success because it's kind of, it's at the spur of the moment. There's not a lot of time. But if you had to give my audience some advice as to how they could improve their accuracy with something like that, what would you say to them?
Well, for one thing, you have to learn to relax and to get into a focused state of attention. So the normal state of consciousness, JV, is the better brainwave state. You have to get into an alpha brainwave state, which is a focused state of attention. So you're focused. You can't remote view. You can't do anything on an intuitive level unless your mind is focused, So it's a hypnotic state. When you do the lucid dreaming, that's a REM state, which is a theta brainwave state. But the alpha state, you have to learn to relax and focus your mind and let whatever impressions come to you. The thing about the remote viewing protocol is that you learn to remote view a target, and you learn to open your aperture, your psychic aperture at will. You open it and you close it. But basically, people remote view, but their aperture is at a 180 degree angle or 360 degrees. They're picking up too much stimulus or too much information, and it doesn't apply to anything that they're really focused on. So basically, you would have a friend. You could have a friend look at a magazine, rip out a page with a picture on it, and then you would tell your friend to give you whatever impressions they're picking up on the image, on the picture, but they would be in an alpha brainwave state first, so which is focus, relaxed state of attention.
When you remote view, how much detail can you pick up? Let's say you were working with somebody, and they're sitting in a room and looking around the room, how much detail of that room can you pick up?
Well, I have, when I learned coordinated remote viewing and extended remote viewing, that's a deeper type of remote viewing. Usually we would do a target and it would be about 30 to 50 pages of data. So remote viewing is not a standalone feature, JV, but okay, it's an information retrieval system. So basically, I have helped some detectives in some cases here in Toronto. And basically, I could fill in a piece of a puzzle that they're missing.
Oh, really? Right? Can you share a specific case with us? Something that helped help law enforcement?
Like a missing person's case, missing person's case. Okay, so now when you learn to remote view, they're not going to give you information ahead of time because you have to be able to develop your ability. But for a missing person's case, I'm being front-loaded. So I'm giving a target where I know there's a person already missing. Right? The least information you get is the better. So a remote viewer will not get any information other than, okay, this is a missing person. All right, so I tell them, okay, it's a missing person. I pick up a female life form. I pick up a energy, of a girl, and she's between 10 and 15 years old, right? And then I write down the information that I have. Her father came in the middle of the night at 3 o'clock in the morning and took his child with him without the mother's knowledge, right? So the police had to find out.
Okay, hold on, Michael.
They knew she was kidnapped, but they didn't know by exactly who.
Michael?
So I would give it some, yes.
I just need some clarification here because the way you just described that to me, and I don't know if it's just the way you're using the example, But you, if you saw, and I'm not sure if this is even a true story that you're giving us here, but if you saw the father come and take the girl at 3 a.m, that's something that happened in the past. That to me is a little bit different than remote viewing. Isn't that more of a psychic connection?
Well, yeah, that's what the remote viewing is, a psychic ability, right?
I think it's clairvoyance, right?
It's a modern terminology for clairvoyance.
Sure, I think there is some clairvoyant components to it, but my understanding of remote viewing has always been, you know, you can see something that is happening contemporarily, like something that's happening at the moment. You can tap into that, but you're actually talking about kind of broadening that, if you will, to include what I would consider to be more of a traditional psychic phenomenon.
Yes, and that's what it is. But viewing is a structure and a protocol, right, that you follow, right? And that you would go deeper into the target. You would what's the emotional state of the child? You know, are they tired? Are they hungry? You know, you could pick up a lot of things. You may pick up a location, you know, where the person is. Pick up a satellite, but you're not judging any of this information that's coming to you. You train yourself to be able to absorb and pick up this information from the matrix, so to speak, and then you would write everything down, you know, and there's a certain, you know, certain structure you follow. You know, you write down the emotional impacts, the tangibles, the intangibles. So there's a lot of detail that goes into a target. That's an actual target that I did, by the way. Yeah. But there's an action. So it could be something about a person, a spy and a company, spies or corporate spies, you know, that exist really in real life. And there are remote viewers in the States. There are groups of them that are hired by multi-billion dollar companies to find out who their spy is. So they would have 10 remote viewers. They would give them these numbers that are associated to the target. And then they would have, you know, 400, 500, 600 pages of data from the 10 remote viewers, and then the monitor would put it all together and then give it to the person. So they would look at that, and each remote viewer does not know what the other one is doing, of course. So they would put it together, and they would, you know, put all the information together, and then it would give them a window. It would give them great information of what's happening. Maybe what kind of, you know, what the spy might look like, what their age category is, or they got a birthmark, you know, on their left hand. Give a description of the person, and so on and so forth. And it'd be 5 or 6 people that would fit that description, and then they would have them followed, and then they would see when the guy gets a briefcase under the table with $250,000 or more, and he would pass off secrets to the other person.
Interesting. If somebody,
that's actual scenarios too.
Yeah, if somebody, law enforcement, or maybe just a private individual, let's say somebody has a loved one that is missing, how would you start with them to help them get some information to maybe locate where that loved one is?
Well, for one thing, they'd have to have confidence in you, right? And, you know, detectives will go to psychics, but remote viewers are trained. Don't forget, psychics may not be. A professional psychic may just keep relying on natural ability. Not to say that they're not psychic or nothing, but you know, going to a remote viewer, you know, for a certain target, it's not good just to have one remote viewer on a target. You want to have 3, 4, or 5, and this way, each remote viewer will pick up a different aspect of the target. You know, once that data is put together, as I mentioned, then they will see a pattern developing there, and then the information, you know, they give an extremely important piece of the puzzle that's missing. And there's medical protocols, by the way, for remote viewing. There's a law enforcement protocol, okay, where it helps detectives, you know, where they have learned it in the States. There's a personal, you know, protocol, of course. And so there's different protocols that you can apply the remote viewing, you know, abilities to.
Do you do that for private clients?
Oh, yeah. I've done it for many private clients. Most of my clients are in the United States. I'm in Canada here. Canada seems to be a little bit reluctant, you know. The law enforcement, you know, here is not as open to it as the American law enforcements are, and I'm not sure why that is, but I do know that a couple of groups in the United States, that they all make a living doing this, where they're professional remote viewers, and they're tasked with a target, you know, for, you know, looking for a, you know, counter, you know, they're looking for either a spy or, you know, in a corporation or who's leaking secrets, or it could be very, you know, important cases, you know. But they're going to work on very, very, you know, important cases. It could be, you know, a billionaire, his son gets kidnapped, you know, who did the kidnapping, why they did it, and so on and so forth. And so the remote viewers have a high statistical success. These two groups that I'm talking about, they're very good. And so once the word gets around, then, you know, you'll be contacted. But it's not openly known to the public, general public.
You, when you do a remote viewing session, one that's particularly intense, does it drain you physically?
No, no. The OBE will drain me much more, and but the remote viewing, basically, it's like looking, it's like seeing a TV screen in your head, and it's like you could go to the target, you could pick up different aspects of the target, you could pick up scents, feel, touches, all kinds of things. You learn to pick up as much of the target as possible, like a sponge. But no, it won't drain you. But it could be, there could be cases where you get a target, okay, where you may connect with a target where the was murdered, you know, or where it's a situation where there was a war zone or something like that. That might be emotionally draining, but you also train yourself not to be affected by that. But it depends. But I don't normally feel drained because I'm, for the extended remote viewing, I'm buying down, and I'm a more natural extended remote viewer, which means I get into a deeper brain state than just the alpha. I get into the alpha instead of brainwave state. But basically, when you're doing the coordinate remote viewing, the basic remote viewing, you're sitting in a comfortable chair with a pen and, you know, lots of paper, and then you're doing the six stages of the protocol. So you stay focused on the target. You don't associate with it personally. You don't know what it is, and you just, it'll come to you. It's like a vision's coming to you. It could be like, you know, you see a page turning quickly, you know, and you see all these impressions, or maybe looking at a TV screen. Sometimes it could be foggy. It could be very clear. You learn to get rid of the white noise, the white sound. You train yourself to do that first because everybody has that. You have to learn to get rid of that, you know, so that you can have clearer images. And sometimes my images can be just as clear as my eyes were open, but I'm not, you know, I'm 2,000 miles away, or maybe I am at the pass. You can remote view the pass, by the way. And the remote viewers in Project Stargate, they remote view the pass and the future. And they did that very successfully.
We've talked about your out-of-body experiences, your escape performances, your remote viewing, but you also talk about UFOs. Tell me how you got involved in talking about UFOs.
Well, when I started having OBEs, and there's a high strangeness that occurs when you have the OBEs or the remote viewing, and when you have these experiences, you'll see these. You know, you see an object in the sky that you wouldn't see physically in the physical world, but you project your second body, your energy body, your astral body. You project, and I go outside. All of a sudden, I see this large craft in the sky, right? And it's what you would call a UFO, but it's not visible in the physical world. It's visible in that state of energy, that locale, right? And the remote viewers and the people that had the OBEs, the remote viewers of Project Stargate, when they remote viewed, they would do the targets, and they would be pulled off target by these strange objects in the sky, which were UFOs. So the remote viewer would automatically be attracted to it like a moth to a light, you know, to a powerful light. So I was also, that happened to me too. So I would go to the object, I wanted to get inside the object, but every time I go near it, it would fly away. And then I would see another one come another distance, I would go after it, and it would fly away. So for years, I see these objects that are not visible to the naked eye, but they're vibrating on a different frequency of energy. So they're visible. They're visible because you're on that same energy level. So what? One year, I made it my goal to want to get one of these ships, and I learned, you know, how to, you know, I was learning to develop my ability better. This was either through the OBE or the remote viewing state, but I learned to tether my mind to the ship. So I was able to get on the ship. So I was able to, and then there were beings inside the ship. And that, but that took me a long time, and it was a great experience.
You said, I think the words you used, vibrate on a different frequency, these craft, and you can see them when you're having the out-of-body experience or the remote viewing because you're on that frequency. Does that phrase, vibrate on a different frequency, equal an alternate dimension? Is it the same thing?
Yeah, you could call it that if you want. The fourth dimension, an alternate dimension. It's a, you know, there are different energy systems, right? And that is it. There's the dream dimension. There's the energy dimension when you project or have a remote view. And so there are a lot of different frequencies in energy, right? You know, that exist in the world. TV, you know, airwaves, radio airwaves are invisible, but they exist. And then there are energy systems and dimensions that exist that are parallel to ours. And then these beings are able to make themselves invisible by vibrating a few seconds maybe into the future. And so they're not visible to the naked eye. But if you project or have a remote viewing session, you will see them. And once you do, you know the target and you go to it. You know, so it's difficult not to, because your curiosity becomes so powerful that you just want to find out what's inside there, right? And as I mentioned, one time I did get on the ship, and it took me a long time, but I did get on, and there were two entities there. And as soon as they got on, they turned and they looked at me, and then I was surprised that they noticed me. I should have been surprised. I thought I was invisible. But they told me to please leave, and I said, no, I'm not going to. What can you do, right? So one being, he had a belt, looked like a belt, and these beings were about 5 feet tall. And he had a belt, looked like it was studded with diamonds. He pulled a rod out of his belt that looked like it was studded with diamonds, and he came towards me. So I didn't have any fear. I learned at this time to eliminate my fear, and he came towards me, and I thought he was going to, I don't know what he was going to do, tell you the truth, maybe give it to me or something, but he almost touched me. And what happened was I got a tremendous electrical shock, and I immediately went right back to my physical body, and I kind of jumped off the bed, you know, with a strong jolt of energy, whatever that hit me. And, you know, it was a great experience because I finally got on board one of those ships.
In any of these experiences when you encountered these beings, did you get any chance to have any kind of conversation with them that would give you some information as to who they are and where they're from?
Yeah, I have. I learned to connect with different life forms that are indigenous to this world, by the way, that are extremely highly advanced, as well as life from other worlds, what you call the worlds, and life forms that exist in other dimensions in between or other locales. I learned not to judge whether who they were in the beginning, whether they were from the future or if they were from whatever, but some of the entities look perfectly human, right? And some of them were non-human, right? And I learned to interact with them to a degree. It looked like they tolerated my presence, right? And there was times where I was told not to stay or whatever. There were times where you could say I crashed the party, and I thought I made myself invisible so that nobody would notice me, but I was visible, you know. And so, but I did find out I did get a lot of information from the beings, and that takes up a couple of books, what I learned. But it's just tremendous experiences that I had as a result.
Yeah, well, it sounds tremendous. So when you're having these out-of-body experiences, you said several times a week, when you have them, now that you can do that at will, do you have an intention? Do you have a deliberate destination that you set to explore? I mean, if you're doing that,
yes.
if you're actually doing this at will, what's your intention and what's the purpose for doing it?
I'll tell you, one of the intentions you learn once you learn how to do this, the physical world is a pretty boring place. Okay, I know that we live in a great world and a great planet, we do, but compared to locale 2 or other energy systems, the physical world is kind of boring and humdrum. So when I project, I learn to shift gears, you could say, and go on to this, you know, super highway or whatever you want to call it, and into the matrix and go to a particular locale, right? But I never know where I'm going to end up always, right? But I have felt like I've been on the moon, Mars. We did get targets, by the way, for Mars. and the Dark Side of the Moon. Military had targets for that too as well. Other places, and I learned, you know, not to bother too much with the physical world. You know, I was stuck here. Like at the beginning, I wanted to have these experiences on another plateau, but I couldn't. So I was kind of stuck in the physical because of my belief systems. But once you learn to do them, you connect with life forms, with beings that have died or passed on, loved ones, people, historical figures, famous people, you know, if they're available, if they're reachable. It's like having a phone number. You have to know their energy signature first, but it's like having to phone someone's number and calling them. They're not going to take a call. You know, they're too busy, or they're going to ignore the voicemail or whatever. So it's not like I can contact anybody who's passed on. You know, your loved ones, you're most likely to connect with. And I have. I've connected with everyone that I've known in my life that has passed on.
Oh, wow.
My best friends, family, my mother. Mm. So I've been able, my stepfather, I've been able to do that and will when I projected. In the beginning, I didn't know how to do it. For example, I would project, right, in my room, and I'd see a telephone, black telephone, the old-fashioned kind, in the corner of my room at a table. It looked like from the 1930s. And in real life, the physical, you know, dimension, there is no little table there with a phone. So I pick up the phone, I say hello. And I wanted to connect with my stepfather, who, guess who's on the other line? My stepfather. You know, I picked up the phone, I said hi. He said, hi, sport, how are you doing? And he was calling, or he was connecting with me from the other side. And I didn't know yet how to shift to get to that side. And I say to him, I talk to him. And after what seemed to be a minute or so, you can't recognize time. There is no time in that state. I asked him, where are you calling from? And when I did, the line went dead. I put the phone, she was back up, down on the phone. I picked it up again. I said hello. And then the conversation resumed like nothing happened. And then a second time, after a little longer talking to my stepdad, I'd asked him, where are you calling from? And then there was a dead air again. And it was very eerie when that happened.
Yeah.
I put the phone down, picked it up again, and said, hi. Conversation resumed. And then I didn't ask where he was calling, where I was, you know, calling from or whatever.
Wow. Some incredible stuff. We're running out of time here.
Yeah.
You know, you've talked about your escapes. You've talked about remote viewing, out-of-body experiences, actually meeting some type of extraterrestrial or alien figure, whatever it happens to be, or interdimensional.
Yeah.
But yes. One of the things I think is probably the most amazing work you do that I read on your website is that you you actually guessed the color of people's underwear. Did I read that correctly?
Yeah. Well, when you become a paranormalist and a mentalist, and you learn techniques of mentalism, and you start really doing the real stuff, then you realize something's going on. So at the time, I was remote viewing, right? And the thing is that you remote view, everybody remote views. You, for example, you get the impression of a person, right? And you're thinking about them, and then the phone rings and it's them. So, you know, you're picking up the impression of them calling you, and they do. But you're not knowing that they're going to call you, of course. But it could be anything. You're thinking of a celebrity in your mind, and you go home, and your girlfriend rented a video with that celebrity on it. So people remote view, it's just that they don't know how to, make sense of the information they're getting because they're not focusing their aperture, their psychic senses, you know, to a particular thing. So anybody can learn how to do these abilities. Everyone possesses these abilities. They're all inherent in all of us, JV. There's no doubt in my mind, right? But you have to believe that you're more than your physical self, because if you don't have that belief, at least, then you're not going to be able to think that there's other finer energies out there. And if you don't think that, then you're not going to think about other dimensions. And we know from quantum physics, there are other dimensions out there, many dimensions, many worlds, many plateaus, and there's just so much that you can do and learn. And it's like you having four lifespans or four different lives, your physical life, your dream life, your astral life, you know, your other life. It's like, you absorb a lot. Let me put it that way. And people say to me, well, Michael, doesn't it drive you crazy being conscious all the time? I say, no, I'm not. There are times where I'm in a delta state where I'm totally unconscious, and I like that. But when you do learn to do this, you're going to find yourself waking up in bed. Maybe you'll be in a hypnagogic state where your body is paralyzed and you can't move, but you could perceive other sounds and things in that state. That's a very fine state, too. So everybody can learn these things, and there are a lot of signs and a lot of techniques, you know, things that they can, you know, learn to develop it. And once you develop them, it expands your world. It really magnifies it a lot, you know. It really opens up your eyes to a lot of possibilities out there. And I like to do this. I like to, you know, use the ability to do my paranormal work, you know, and telling about the other or whatever. That's just simple stuff, you know. But, that was just having some fun with the ability, right?
Michael, your website is your name, MichaelTelstar.com. That's where people can get more information about contacting you or booking you or just keeping up on your work. Anything else you want people to know
people
about?
People could write to me, ask your questions. People welcome to look at my site. It's two R's on Telstar, by the way, T-E-L-S-T-A-R-R. And there are tips and techniques there on how to get into the second state and how to lucid dream. And, I'm open to whatever, you know. And I know this COVID-19, the year is really making it kind of difficult for a lot of people to do what they want to do.
Yeah.
But I think you should use the extra time and have a look at my techniques, methods, you know. And if anybody has a question or whatever, they're feel free to write me through my website.
That's terrific. Thanks for your time, Michael. Thanks for being here tonight. It was a great conversation. Appreciate it.
Yes, and I hope to see you or talk to you again soon, JB.
Sounds great. Okay, once again, it's Michael Telstar. Telstar is T-E-L-S-T-A-R-R.
Beyond Reality Paranormal is hosted by JV Johnson and produced by Orion Palmer and Slick Eddie Edwards. Like us on Facebook and subscribe to our YouTube channel. Please consider supporting the program either through your podcast platform, click on the link in the description, or on Patreon at Joha Productions. If you'd like to be a guest on Beyond Reality Paranormal or you have a recommendation for a guest, contact our producer, Slick Eddie Edwards. Eddie is spelled with a Y at slickeddieedwards@gmail.com.